One of my favorite professors used to come into the classroom and say, "Mr. Jones," or all too often, "Mr. Myers, will you please stand up beside your desk and summarize for me and for your fellow classmates what we discussed in our last meeting?" It was slow death to be caught without a good response to that question. So the last thing we did before class was to think about what we had studied a couple of days before. It was a good way of making sure we came in all set to pick up where we had left off. It also made 20 other students whose names were not called extremely happy, which is also a good way to start a class. So I was not surprised when this man came into the room on an April morning about like this and said, "Mr. Myers, may we have the privilege of seeing you on your feet, please, ready to enlighten those of us who dwell in darkness." I was all set to reel off the high points from our last class, and he knew this, so he threw me a curve. He said, "I want you to imagine, Mr. Myers, that you are living back in the first century in a little apartment in the working class section of Jerusalem at a time when the biggest news in town is being made by a man named John, also called the Baptizer, who is holding a big revival meeting out in the desert just south of town. How do you suppose, Mr. Myers, you would have responded to all that excitement?" Well, we had all read the text, which John Conley read this morning. John doesn't sound right. Bill, that's why it doesn't sound right. It's catching. Mr. Scott. We'd all read that text about how some people thought John was the Messiah that had been predicted for so many centuries, but we had read it with insider information, living at the end of 20 centuries of Christian history. We knew the whole story and how it came out. So it was obvious to us that these people were rather foolish, a little blind. Surely there must have been signs that John was merely the forerunner, the eccentric introducer, the man who laid down the proverbial red carpet for the real Messiah. Certainly an admirable man in some ways, this John the Baptist, if a little crazy and more than a little eccentric. But only the warm-up act, after all, whose sole purpose in coming on stage was to get off stage before people got bored. That's what all of us in that class believed. A more pro-Jesus crowd you could hardly have found anywhere. But then our beloved professor set out to confuse us, which is the purpose of all good teaching at first, to subvert what is assumed, to stir up the sediment of what everyone knows and nobody thinks about. So he said to me, but the whole class knew that he was saying it to them, and would turn on them in a second if they dared show too much unholy joy at my predicament. He said to me, "If you had been around in those early days of John the Baptist and Jesus, which one would you have sided with?" I have one of those wonderful memory blocks right now about what my answer was, except that it was not the answer he wanted, and which he proceeded to give all of us in some detail. It went like this. John would have seemed to everybody to have the advantage, first of all, in his immediate family. His father was a priest. His mother came from a long line of priests. And they are given a much higher compliment than is ever paid in Scripture to Joseph and Mary. Zacharias and Elizabeth are praised as truly religious people, blamelessly observing all God's commandments and requirements. When Luke introduces us to that other pair, he simply speaks of a young woman who was engaged to a man called Joseph. Nobodies. So John wins the first round. When the boys grew up, John got the first publicity. And for a while, he certainly got far more of it than his cousin from up in the hill country. He knew how to market himself, a kind of early Brian Bosworth, with a white Corvette and an earring and a full-length fur coat. Only in John's case, it was the eccentricity of poverty that made him famous. A ragged old coat made of camel's hair, a piece of scuffed leather around his waist, fire and brimstone sermons, and a diet of fried locusts and a little wild honey for dessert when he could find it. Many of you are too young to remember Abby Hoffman from the wild 60s, but for those who do remember, John the Baptist was probably a mix of Abby Hoffman and Jimmy Swaggart. He had charisma, color. He was a man to dominate the evening news. And what about Jesus? Known to a handful of village folk as the child of Joseph and Mary? Well, who knows? A quiet man who works in the carpenter's shop. He's had some strange ideas in his head lately, and he's decided to come and see this wild preacher 100 miles south, pulling big crowds out into the desert. But Jesus of Nazareth in the quiet little town, no one to get very much excited about. John even had the dramatic good sense to die in a spectacular way, with his head cut off and put on a platter and carried by a gorgeous dancing girl as a present to her mother. Now that's a finale made for Hollywood. Broadway, tragic theater at its best. And how did his cousin die? Well, a mob voted on whether to free him or a common bandit, and they freed the bandit. And Jesus died, after all, in a rather ordinary way. We forget how ordinary, because we only remember his death. But hundreds and thousands of criminals and revolutionaries had been executed by the state on those two pieces of wood. Jesus himself had probably seen several crucifixions near his hometown when he was still just a child. It was not uncommon. But a head on a platter, beard hanging over the edge, blood congealing around the ragged neck, they must have talked about that for years. And in between, well, they both preached, but John jumped on everybody and scratched and clawed, and the crowds loved it. When the Pharisees and Sadducees came out to see what was going on, he called them a bunch of rattlesnakes. And he said, "You think that you are God's own special people, that your folks came over on the Mayflower? Well, let me tell you that he can land a whole new set of pilgrims any minute to do his will." Some rich man out in the crowd laughed because he didn't like the church bunch anyway. And John turned on him in a flash and said, "You have two coats? Share one. You have plenty of food? Give some to the hungry." His eyes roamed the crowd and caught a tax collector. He yelled at him, "Quit cheating people. Collect no more than you are supposed to." How the audience must have cheered. And especially, if they dared, when he saw a couple of soldiers hanging around the edge of the crowd and said, "Why don't you boys stop robbing people by violence and by false accusation and be content with what they pay you?" And just when the rest of the crowd was feeling good, he turned on them and said being a Jew would not get them any more points than being a Hottentot, and that if they didn't shape up, God would cut them down like an elm tree with the blight or burn them up like a cartload of chaff. Oh, John was the talk of the town. There must have been John the Baptist jokes. Who can out-dunk Michael Jordan? You have to think about baptism. Who's number one on the top 10 worst-dressed men in Palestine? Have you bought John's 24 recipes for frying fresh grasshoppers? John would be on television today, and he would scream a lot, denouncing secular humanism and college professors. And the pill. And people would be fascinated with him because they like it simple, neat, and clean. Black or white, and that's how John was. Either you're one of us or you're one of them. And if you're one of them, you'd better step over here and let me put you under the water. John got so popular, his ratings soared so high that people began to think he was the prophet Elijah come back from the dead, or even, and who can blame them, the Messiah. The highest tag that could be hung around anybody's neck. "So, class," the professor said, "which man would have seemed like the Messiah to you? Jesus or John?" Even John had second thoughts about Jesus and sent somebody from his prison cell one day to ask Jesus who he was, whether or not he was really the Messiah, or should we look for somebody else? And it must not have helped John very much when Jesus said, "He wants proof? Well, tell him that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the poor have good news preached to them. In other words, reconsider the kingdom, John. Reconsider the kingdom. Maybe it's to come through love and tenderness rather than through violent judgment." Poor John. He had spent his life and finally lost it, drawing a sharp line between the saints and the sinners. And along comes this cousin preaching love and forgiveness. John's God was angry, a divine bouncer. But the Father of Jesus was the host of a different kind of party, where the rejected and the outcasts get invited in to sit in the best seats, and the guest of honor cannot bring himself to throw anybody out even when they spit in his eye. I understand why John was confused and why so many in his audience were confused, because where John said people had better save their skins before it was too late, Jesus said it was God who saved their skins. Amazing grace. And even if you blew your whole bankroll on liquor and sex like the prodigal son, it still wasn't too late. And where John ate those crispy little fried locusts and hoped for a bee tree once in a while, Jesus ate what he felt like eating in Jerusalem with as sleazy a bunch as you could ever hope to run into. It was the scandal of the time. Where John seemed to cross over to the other side of the street when he saw a sinner coming and then made him an example in the next sermon, Jesus prefers the company of certain sinners to the company of some of the council members and the deacons. John tried to frighten people into a better life. That's always been a popular way in some pulpits. Jesus tried to make the better life so irresistible that people would be drawn to it. John stressed how bad people were. Jesus stressed how good they could be. John saw life in terms of catastrophes. Jesus saw in it the grace of God, slow and infinitely patient. And you can be glad. In the kingdom as John saw it, you talk about rights and duties and laws and punishments. In the kingdom as Jesus saw it, the talk is all of a strange and gentle and incredibly strong power called love. A relationship in which people no longer say, I'm better than you are, or even I'm as good as you are, but you and I will love and serve together because we are both the children of God. John went down like some giant redwood, scattering debris and thundering with his last breath against a pair of royal sinners. Jesus spoke quietly through his long, drawn-out agony. Father, forgive them. We might have chosen John as the most likely Messiah. But in a moment, when we unite around this table, we choose the other man, the man of forgiveness and of hope. And in his name, we make stronger than ever the bonds of love that make us one in this place. Amen.